The rivalry between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali went far beyond the boxing ring. Just days before their second fight, 1974's Ali Frazier II, the heavyweights met at ABC's New York television studios for an interview with Howard Cosell. Well,
that shows you how dumb
people
don't
go in.
That shows how dumb you are. How
come Ali called Frazier ignorant. Frazier rose from his chair and stood over Ali. Their handlers tried to intervene, but soon the two were wrestling on the floor.
Well, we're having a scene, as you can see, and it's hard to tell whether it's clowning or for real between the two fighters.
It was real, and it kept going. Over the years, Ali called Frazier a savage, a gorilla, and an Uncle Tom. Ali later apologized, but his words hurt Frazier, because much of what people thought they knew about him wasn't true. Only A Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Joe Frazier was born in 1944 in Beaufort, South Carolina. He was one of 12 children. His father was a bootlegger.
His mother picked vegetables in the fields, as did many other members of his family.
That's writer Mark Cram Jr.
He grew up in a house that was more or less a shack. He grew up amid malnutrition, disease, and essentially the enslavement of the Jim Crow laws. You couldn't look a white man or a white woman, and particularly a white woman, in the eye for fear of retribution. He said that Buford never got tired of reminding you that you were the N-word.
But Frazier's mother had a rule.
Dolly would not stand for anything said about white people. You know, if her kids made some sort of offhanded remark, she'd slap them down. She wouldn't stand for it.
But that didn't mean Frazier suffered abuse easily. Once, when Joe was in his teens, he was working at a farm in Beaufort. When a white foreman threatened to take a belt to another young African American, Frazier stopped him. He just couldn't stand watching others being pushed around.
And that's fundamental to his nature.
In 1959, Frazier saw no future in Beaufort outside of working in the fields and helping his father run the family still. So he hopped on a Greyhound bus headed for New York City, where he joined members of his extended family. He was just 15. But there wasn't much of a future in New York City either.
He found it hard to find work and to supplement what little money he had. He and a friend would steal cars and sell them to junkyards. There was a sense among his family that if he stayed in New York, it wouldn't be a positive outcome for him. So they sent him down to Philadelphia to live with his sister, Maisie. She sat down with Joe and she said, "Look, if you get into trouble down here, there's nothing I can do for you."
Maisie suggested that Joe join the Police Athletic League. At least he'd be safe in a gym filled with cops.
So he went over to the gym, and when he hit the heavy bag, it made such a resounding crack that you could hear it across the street.
Over the next few years, Frazier rose quickly up the boxing ranks. He won gold at the 1964 Olympics. In 1968, he captured the New York Athletic Commission heavyweight title, which marked the beginning of a long championship run.
Muhammad Ali rocked him to the rope. He almost went down.
In 1971, Frazier fought Muhammad Ali in what was billed as the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden. In the lead-up to the fight, Ali intensified his attacks on Frazier, saying he was too dumb and ugly to be champ, and calling him an Uncle Tom for working with white trainers. It was the biggest sporting event of the year.
The winner by unanimous decision, and still heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Frazier.
Frazier was now a celebrity. Politicians wanted to see and be seen with him. On April 7th, 1971, just 1 month after his win over Ali, Frazier became the first African-American man to speak before the state legislature in Columbia, South Carolina.
It was an extraordinary event. He reached out and tried to implore the members of that assembly to be open to bringing the races together, and he wanted to.
Frazier told the legislature that not much had changed since he left Beaufort, about 140 miles south of the state capital. And he said,
"We must save our people.
And when I say our people, I mean white and black.
That's an actor reading from Joe Frazier's address.
We need to quit thinking who's living next door, who's driving a big car, who's my little daughter going to play with, who is she going to sit next to in school?
Publicly, they were all for it. The governor was behind him. The politicians shook his hand. They were thrilled to have him. He was the champ.
After his address to the state legislature, Frazier sent a representative to Beaufort to propose the building of a public playground that he would pay for himself. But when officials learned that Frazier wanted the playground to be open to black children and white children, with one water fountain for all of them,
he was slapped down.
When news reached Frazier in Philadelphia that Beaufort officials wouldn't agree to his terms,
Joe said forget it then, because he wasn't going to be a party to furthering the separatism. It bothered Joe. That's not what Joe was about.
While Frazier was losing this private battle, Ali continued attacking him in public. In May of 1971, Frazier took a portion of his $2.5 million Fight of the Century purse and purchased the Bruton Plantation in Beaufort.
His family, generations back, had been enslaved in places of this sort, and now he was the owner of one. The symbolism shouts at you.
Frazier's mother lived at Bruton Plantation along with other family members. Frazier continued to live in Philly, but
he basically kept his ties to Beaufort. In fact, all during his life, he was connected to Beaufort.
Joe Frazier's boxing career ended in 1981. He continued to run his boxing gym.
He was available. You didn't need to make an appointment to find Joe Frazier in Philadelphia. All you had to do was walk up to the gym on North Broad Street, walk in, and he would have genuine time for you. He performed all these acts of generosity that the public never really knew about or found out about. He would see a motorist stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire, and he would pull over, get out of his car, get the jack out of the trunk, and fix the tire. He did this not just once, but again and again. It was almost as if he was his own AAA. And, you know, his friends who were driving with him, it became such a commonplace occurrence that they say, oh, Joe, not again. He'd say, well, what if it was your mother that was stranded there?
On a cold December day in 1986, Joe was driving in Philadelphia with his son and another boxer. He spotted a legless man in a wheelchair trying to cross Broad Street. The man had a can of kerosene in his lap.
Joe pulled over, stopped in the middle of Broad Street, got out of the car in his fur coat and a cowboy hat, picked the guy up and put him in his car, drove him home.
The only items in the man's home were a table and chairs, a television, and two kerosene heaters.
The man's wife couldn't believe that Joe Frazier was standing there in the middle of her living room, and he takes a roll out of his sock and peels off a couple hundred dollars. And the guy says, why are you doing this? He couldn't believe it. And Joe would say, you need help, man. That was his nature. In a sport that many think is inhumane, Joe had a great humanity. He was a good man, not a perfect man, but a good man.
Joe Frazier made many trips back to Beaufort to visit family. Over the years, he noticed that something had changed.
He would come to town and he was treated very well, far better than he was when he was even champ.
In 2010, Joe Frazier was presented with the Order of the Palmetto, South Carolina's highest civilian award. The state that had rejected Frazier's vision of racial harmony was now honoring him. Ali tried on many occasions to apologize for his name-calling, but Frazier refused to forgive him. Joe Frazier died in 2011. What did the boxing world in particular and the greater world in general lose?
Someone who understood that being the champion meant more than just holding a belt in your hand. It meant that you had a voice. And even if you did not use that voice in the public square, you could use it privately and in ways that helped people along the way. He understood that.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Mark Cram Jr.'s new book is called Smokin' Joe, The Life of Joe Frazier.